session number 27741, Reel 2.
Say, this is Reel 2 with Michael LePage. So, do you want to have a break or do you want to go on?
I'm getting a bit warm, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Can we have a I can just... Right. You were talking about the warm weather, the cold weather gear that you were wearing. This was January 1943.
Yeah.
And you were going up for the first time.
Yes. With the instructor, I could find out his name in my logbook, which I still got over there. But we did, usually it was circuits and bumps, only about 20 minutes at a time, probably, until we got used to that. And then, as I say, three spins to the left and three spins to the right. And then
the instructor would put the plane into a spin and you'd have to get it
yes,
out?
Yes, that's right. Mm.
And how was that? Was that pretty well, terrifying?
Well, it was a sort of the talk of the course. If you course number 42, I can't remember exactly. But we went right through with the same people all the way through, which is good, right to the end of training, until we split up into different squadrons. But that was good because we had a good esprit de corps.
Same instructors as well? Or?
No. The instructors were, I mean, each place had its own cadre of instructors. But as a course, we went through, we were people dropping out now and then who failed the exams or failed the tests or whatever, but by and large we went right through to what was about a year's training, just over, well, yes, until we got on to the operational aircraft, it was nearly a year.
Well, yeah, but I mean, what about taxiing and airport drills?
Yes.
We could talk a little bit more about the actual.
Well, it was a grass-covered airport, no runways. There was one runway because they were testing mosquitoes at the same place, repairing and testing the engines, servicing. But for us, we just used the grass strip by the D and did got on to cross-country flying a little bit and navigation. But it was carefree, pretty existence. Went into Chester on evening leave-outs and had meals together in different places. I remember the train back from Chester, it was all black out, and sometimes quite difficult to know which station you were at and whether you were going to get out of the right one, especially on the line later when we were down at Fareham, getting down to Lyons, to Daedalus, getting off at Fareham. You never knew. There were so many stops on that train. But the blackout, and but we were well housed. There was a good naffy, I remember, where the Salvation Army used to run. Snooker table. I still play snooker a bit, but enjoy a game. But, of course, we couldn't. There's none of that on ship. Oh, Shove Halfpenny is a game we used to play a lot, and I haven't seen that around for ages. But that was quite intriguing when you get on board ship. You have to aim off a bit sometimes for the roll of the ship.
What's that taught you? Going on a bit.
But anyway, we learned Shove Halfpenny at that place. Yeah. They had all the usual games and entertainments. ENSA, remember? Entertainment. What was it called? ENSO. I forgot what it stood for now. But it was basically the entertainment of troops. And, we had big names come around sometimes. The Gracie Fields, what are the people? I can't remember the names now, but we used to have some big people come around to entertain us in the evenings. But I used to try to, weekend, we had occasional weekend leaves. I used to go and visit friends or relatives. I had an uncle in Liverpool, in Manchester, and a friend in Liverpool. I went to Liverpool Philharmonic. I remember seeing Maura Limpany, who is a local here in Devon, or Cornwall, was she in? I think she came from Saltash. But she was playing as a young 17-year-old with the Liverpool Philharmonic at that time. Wonderful. So we had a bit of culture now and then.
And so the training on the Tiger Moss, how long did that last?
Well, we were there for, was it 2 or 3 months?
And you were taught about stalling and gliding, yes, stalling, and what happened if engines... I mean, can you...
Engine failure, precautionary landings, as say if the engine was stuttering, sputtering, emergency landings, of course. Being able to land on a grass stretch, we could have landed in a field. But later on, of course, then we got onto the faster aircraft. They had to have a runway, the Harvards and the rest. But I'm afraid I can't really remember all that much about the flying, the Sealand flying business, except it was interesting. And the tremendous exhilaration of being when the instructor climbed out finally and said, "Okay, you've got it, off you go."
Did you expect that? Did you know this particular day you'd be doing
No, because you had to reach a certain standard. He had to decide when you were competent to do one circuit and one landing by yourself. But to be up on your own for the first time, as everybody says, it's exhilarating. It certainly was. But anyway, I managed it without pranging.
And talking of pranging, were there many...
Not at that stage, no. Not very many, no. But later on, I'll come to that later.
All right. So, now let's see. You've finished your Tiger Moth training. You've passed that.
Yeah.
Where do you go next?
Next was out to Canada for intermediate flying training. And this was on Harvards, which were much more developed.
How did you get out to Canada?
A troop ship, the Louis Pasteur, was a French liner. It hadn't been used as a liner. It converted to a troop ship before she did a maiden voyage. So we went actually on the maiden voyage from Liverpool to Halifax. This was 1943, April, blackout, mist, snow, cold in Liverpool, and she relied on her speed, of course, to dodge the submarines, because she was a fast ship.
This is more or less at the peak of the submarine war.
Yes, it was, yes, well, we just didn't think about it too much. The chief thing I remember there was that they, being her maiden voyage, they hadn't realized all the things they ought to have tightened up, and some of the hatches hadn't been battened down well enough, and the water got into our baggage compartment and into our deck. We were right on the base, G deck, fortunately in hammocks, so we were off the deck, but we woke up in the morning to a sloshing water sloshing to and fro underneath the hammocks on the deck, with socks and books and all sorts of things floating one way or another, and a lot of people lost their bag, their sea got into their. We had kit bags. There were no suitcases in those days, and the clothing was ruined. You know.
Why did you go to Canada with clothes?
Well, that's to avoid the war zone, to be able to fly unmolested, obviously. And this was part of the. The RAF used bases there in Canada too, at Calgary and Banff and places. We were at Kingston, Ontario, on the shores of Lake Ontario.
What was it like landing in Halifax after leaving wartime Britain?
Yes, tremendous contrast, yes. We were shifted straight to a transit camp at Moncton, New Brunswick, and the streets were blazing lights. I still remember the blazing lights. And the food, of course, was out of the way. I mean, eggnogs, and we'd go down the town and we just gorged ourselves after the privations of English rationing. Then we were there for about a week, I think, before we took the train, long, slow journey up through New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, down through Montreal, and all down the St. Lawrence Valley to Kingston. And that was where we did our IFTS, intermediate flying, for 4 months. Well, that was good. I liked that.
What was it like being introduced to the Harvard?
Harvard was
the Tiger Moth.
Yes, it was a much more complicated cockpit. You had to deal with the variations you could put on the propeller, on the air screw. it had something called coarse and fine pitch. Fine pitch was the screw would go around quicker, give you more pull, and that was used for takeoff and landing, obviously. Coarse pitch was when the blades were turned a bit and you go more, fly more economically at altitude. Then there was mixture as well. You had to adjust the mixture so to be able to fly, not to fly on too, it was like the choke on the car. Undercarriage was retractable. We had a cockpit check, which was read by the mnemonic of BUMF.
Can you explain?
Brakes, undercarriage, mixture, pitch, and flaps.
This is before you took off?
No, this is coming into land. Well, for takeoff, you had to have fine pitch, mixture, and then you just opened the throttle, of course. But the undercarriage, you didn't select up until you were airborne. But coming into land, you had to be sure that you got the undercarriage down, obviously, and that you were in fine pitch, so that if you had to go round again suddenly in emergency, you were on full power. Then you had lots of dials, particularly the turn and bank indicator, which was vital, because that showed you what attitude you were in. And along with this flying, we had link training. A link is a simulated, like a simulator. You get in and shut the roof, and you can't see anything except the panel in front of you, and you have to fly by all the instruments. And the turn and bank indicator gives you your attitude, whether you're nose up, nose down, or left wing down, right wing down. It's vital. It all worked by gyroscopes. And then, of course, the direction compass was also a gyro compass. So all that training was quite much more complicated than the Tiger Moth, where you just flew by the seat of your pants and what you could see.
And how? I mean, it must have been a bit daunting, I imagine.
Yes, it was a challenge. I forget how quickly we went up in the. I mean, we'd done probably 50 hours of flying by then, I suppose. I can't remember exactly how many, but we were fairly sure about what. Obviously, there must have been a lot of cockpit drill before we took off, but that was much more challenging.
They were. I mean, you went up with an instructor again.
Yes, they were two-seaters, but we weren't always with an instructor. Obviously, sometimes we were solo. And we did a lot of, over Lake Ontario, we did quite a bit of work of spotting, bombing, dive bombing, and dropping fluorescence, fluorine, I suppose, some colouring matter, so that they could see where the bag had dropped.
And you'd release this bomb from a proper...
From the bomb bay underneath, yes. It was all practice. I don't know if we did any firing. I don't think we did, because they didn't have any guns. They were purely training aircraft.
What about fire drills? Were you taught to do if, say, fire broke out in the aircraft?
No, we didn't have very much of that. Well, obviously, escape drill, because you were sitting on your parachute, which was strapped on, and then you were strapped in with straps into the aircraft, so that if you did land in a emergency landing, you, like your seatbelt, you would be restrained. But these were proper straps over the shoulder and over the legs, so that... because the impact would have been much greater than in the car. So, yes, we had to learn emergency drill. I remember one friend of mine came in. They were doing precautionary landings, which is rather like we had to do later on the deck of a carrier. You come in just above stalling speed. Stalling speed is when the wings won't give lift anymore. And... he came in and touched down just a bit too early before the runway and flipped right over onto his back. Well, fortunately, the Harvard had a very strong canopy roof over the cockpit, and he and the instructor just walked away.
Instructors must have had strong nerves. The instructors were Canadians or Brits as well?
Most of them were Brits. So there were quite a number of Canadians, I remember now, yes, Canadian Air Force, RCAF.
And they were veterans, they'd been in combat, and they were much older than you?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I had a friend who was RAF, and he went in on the instructors in Western Canada, and he was there for quite a long time, but he was English. He's pretty well stone deaf now, as a result of flying chipmunks or something.
What did you think of the instructors? I mean, your Tiger Moth instructors, going back to that, what was your opinion of them? Were they good ones, bad ones?
Oh, yes, they were, but we didn't mix for all that much, because they were officers and we were ratings. We were leading aircraftmen by then, like, as I say, like a corporal. But we didn't meet very much off duty.
But when you were in the air and they were teaching you, did you think, oh, this guy is not at all good at what he does?
Some of them, yes, they were a mixed bag. But most of them were. I think it must have been a bit of a dead end job for them, you know, doing the same thing over and over again with course after course coming through. So, having become a teacher later on in life, I know something of what it must have meant.
You said when you were doing the training in the Tiger Moth that you had to throw the aircraft around a bit.
Mm.
What did that involve? We leap briefly back to that.
I don't know whether we did loops and rolls in the Tiger Moth. I think we probably did, because it's a very aerobatic machine. You can throw it around all over the place, unlike modern aircraft. But of course, it didn't have the draw, the pull that a modern jet has. Just a two-bladed air screw, which the IRCs, we used to call the ground crew IRCs. It was just like Biggles, you know. We had two switches in the cockpit. You'd put the switches down, contact, and he'd say contact, and then he'd grab hold of the air screw and give it a twist, and like an old car engine. But they were very versatile aircraft in that you could do all sorts of loops and everything with them. I remember, yeah, doing loop to loop and roll off the top. But nothing very...
And with the Harvards, you did the same?
Oh, yes, yes. They were faster.
If you were dive-bombing and...
Yes.
Obviously, you had to be comfortable with...
Proficient, yes. And formation flying.
How did they train you to do that?
Again, with the instructor, you had to tuck your wing behind the wing of the leader. But didn't do very much of that, because... But it meant you had to control the aircraft, and especially the throttle, keeping just the right speed alongside the other chap.
And engine failure, restarting the engine in flight?
Oh, yes, all that sort of thing, yes. Nose diving, emergency landings.
How would they train you for an emergency landing?
Well, they bring you in with the instructor, just on the approach, but just when you got near enough to the ground, just think you've got it right, they open the throttle and move and go off. Didn't actually do it.
Naturally. What did you think of the Harvard after the Tiger Moth? It might be like going on to a Rolls Royce.
Yeah, well, it was very complicated, but it was nice being able to get more power. They were direct drive. I don't know if direct drive, there's no reduction in the engine to this air screw. So they made an awful noise. It was coming over. You could always tell a Harvard coming. This sort of grinding, wow, noise. Noisy things. But in the cockpit, they were okay. But it meant that when we came back to England, there were 4 months there at intermediate. And advanced flying training. Then we were due to come back to England.
You've done night flying, you've done instrument flying.
Yes, night flying at a place called Gananoque, which I went back to a few years ago to see where we were.
How was it, night flying? Did you find it intimidating, landing at night?
That was difficult, yes, but again, it was a nice challenge. A big flare path. In Canada, you could have as much light as you wanted. So we had a course of, I think, four or five days doing nothing but night flying. I never actually had to land on a carrier at night, for which I was profoundly grateful.
Later on. You did no gunnery, or you did bombing practice, but no gunnery in Canada.
I can't remember. I think we must have done gunnery with a drogue, you know, a light aircraft towing a drogue. But that would have been over Lake Ontario. But I don't remember doing much of that. I did some later in Scupper Flow. I had 3 weeks up there and did quite a lot of ground support. That's a later story.
Were there any failures on the Harvard? Did people flunk out at this stage?
Oh, yes. So people dropping out all along. We started with about 40 and finished up with about 24, I think. I don't think we would regard them as failures so much as sidelining, you know, I think some went into to be observers. I suppose the very early on ones who failed would have gone into something quite different, maybe stores or ground stuff. Yes.
What was the reason that most people failed the course on
Harvard? Oh, I could say now, no. Early on, it would have probably been the tests, the academic knowledge tests, maths or whatever. Quite a lot of maths, computing, working out courses and track and according to wind speed and air meteorology as well as climates. But later on in the flying, it would have been probably unsuited to flying advanced or fast aircraft or something at Harvard stage. But we survived.
Were you using that computer you mentioned, the Dayton computer?
Dalton, sorry. Yes, it was a sort of...
You used that on Harvard's too?
Yes. Oh, yes, we had nothing else.
What was it?
It was a sort of revolving, rather like a calendar which you turn over from one beginning of the month to the end. A wheel at each end with a sheet of plastic and computed in a fan-shaped lines. So you could enter, if you wanted to get from A to B, you knew the track, that's the on the ground, was 176 degrees, for example. You would put that on the computer. You then know that you had a certain amount of wind blowing from, say, from the west to 270 at certain knot speed. So you could put that onto the, I forget how it went, onto the side, and that would give you the course. That's to say, where you would aim the nose, or where you would steer on the compass. And your course would be, you'd go perhaps like a crab, but you'd hopefully follow the track and arrive where you wanted to be. And that was all worked out on this very primitive thing we call a computer, nothing like modern ones. I mean, it's just purely manually operated, and you just put in your dick with a ballpoint with a pencil.
Did you ever get lost when you were doing cross-country trips?
Not that I remember. We did them all over Canada, all over Ontario. Went out to flew to Ottawa, once over Ottawa and back. The name of the place, Peterborough, I seem to remember the name of one or two places. But we did just one or two cross-country flights, but I don't remember getting lost. Canada's not so bad. England is a place to get lost in because there's so many rivers, roads, railways, and it's quite easy to make a mistake.
But you didn't do that on your tiger moth training?
No, well, we didn't go very far. I went out to North Wales when Mould, I remember going over Mould and down to Hodnet or somewhere.
When that course then came to an end, the Harvard course,
yep.
you were happy with the training. You thought you'd been well trained.
Yes. Well, I mean, we were looking forward then to. We got commissioned at the end of that. Commissioned. We got back to England. We were then either chief petty officers or sub lieutenant, RNVR,
Why were some chief petty officers somewhere?
That was left to the train instructors. There were very few CPOs, very few failed the OLQ, officer-like qualities, which were demanded in those days. All thankfully rather changed now, I think.
It was a class judgment, really, if you became a CPO. I mean, you might be to end up in the flying in the same squadron, but...
I hope it wasn't class. I mean, I think it was the ability to command other men. You know, I mean, if you were in a capacity as an officer on a ship, you had to become officer of the watch sometimes. You had to be able to know the right things to say to a bunch of men falling in front of you. And if some people didn't have this ability to command, I suppose you would call it, I don't know. I'm sure that others would know more about that than I do, but well, there are very few. I think there were only two who became CPOs on our course out of the 24 or so.
And how long was the course then, in the end, the Harvard course?
The Harvard course was 4 months, quite long. There were two months on intermediate and 2 months on advanced. And at the end of that, we were supposed to be ready to go into a frontline aircraft. Actually, we had to do another month on the English cockpit, on the master, Miles Master, because there was a different layout. And before going into a seafire, we had to adjust.
But you did that back in England, presumably?
Yeah, in Scotland, actually.
So let's go to that. What, the journey back across the Atlantic?
On the QE2, yes, none other. But that was just before D-Day, and the American troops were coming over in their hordes. There were 17,000 on the QE2, and just a couple of hundred of us naval fleet air arm chaps. So 17,000 trying to get meals each day. They only had room in the dining hall for a certain number, and we had two meals a day, six sittings for each meal. So they'd call out, the last call for chow, you know, which was a sixth sitting. If you missed that, that was breakfast, about 11 o'clock, and then they started the evening meal at about 2. So the NAFI did well with biscuits and things you made up. It was only 6 days, 4 days at sea, a day embarking at Halifax, and a day disembarking at Liverpool. But again, the QE2 depended on her speed, zigzagged across the Atlantic. And
no escort?
No. Well, I think we were picked up by liberators probably somewhere off the Irish coast or somewhere halfway across. The liberators had a fantastic range in the Catalinas. But no, nothing on the other side. So we were a bit conscious at that time of what might happen if 18,000 people had gone to the bottom.
Back to wartime Britain.
To wartime Britain, yes.
How was that this is spring?
I have very little memory of what happened when we got back. I must have had some leave, I think, a week or so, and then up to Errol in Scotland, between Perth and Dundee, where we did this a month on masters. My initials being MC, I was addressed as Sub-Lieutenant McClappage on one occasion by a shopkeeper in Perth. But I've always had a soft spot for Scotland. I've got a very good friend who's now, who lives in Glasgow, and we shared things at school. But enjoyed myself there at Errol, and there was a big castle nearby. I don't know if there's anything to do with the Lord Errol of Kenya, where I went later, but... That was less famous, famous for something less. Have you read the Errol story, the white? Never mind, that's beside the point. Anyway, yes, enjoyed the time there. And
what was the base like? Were you in tents or?
No, we were in Nissen huts again. All the time we were in England, we were in Nissen huts. Very cold in the winter. I'll come on to that later in Northern Ireland. Because they only had one fire, one stove in the middle of the room, and two bare electric light bulbs dangling from the top of the Nissen hut. No cladding, no lining. Yes, Errol, that was October 1943, and it was getting cold. I chiefly remember that chap landing without his undercarriage down on night flying and seeing the real display of sparks. It was quite a firework display.
Did he survive?
Oh, yes. He just skidded along the runway.
And would he have been bounced out of the course?
I don't think he was on our course, but I think he would have been severely reprimanded. I don't know whether he was actually failed. It depends on his other record, probably. But
what was it like, the new drill? I mean, learning the new cockpit. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Not all that different. I mean, you had basically the same turn and bank indicator, the boost, the amount of revs, the rev counter, boost counter, which was the amount of energy going into the engine,